It's 2:22 a.m. in Yelm, Washington, and you're listening to Night Call. Hello, and welcome back to Night Call, a call-in show for our dystopian reality. I am in Los Angeles. I am Tess Lynch, and with me are
Molly Lambert and
Emily Yoshida.
We were going to be joined by Mara Wilson today, but unfortunately she had some technical difficulties, so she will be on the podcast next week.
We have a night call we want to take right off the top in honor of the recent finale of The Vow on HBO. This is a night email, actually, and it is anonymous, and it is juicy. Okay. So they write, really enjoying all of the conversation around The Vow and glad to hear I'm not the only one who seems to have been driven crazy by many aspects of the series. How did Keith pull this thing off? Where is Mark to blame in all of this? Why do so many of these ladies have bad eyebrows? What the hell is up with this series narrative structure? Who shortens Anthony to Nippy? Great question. Anyway, back in 2012, I was working at an unscripted production company that was shopping around a project about the housekeepers of Beverly Hills homes. I'm sure you can guess what the very clever title was. The sizzle was tasteless even for the time. We were talking the height of Jersey Shore and the eve of Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, and featured long sequences of the housekeepers just cleaning fancy houses. One of the featured housekeepers was employed by none other than the daughter of Princess Elizabeth of Yugoslavia, Dynasty's Amanda Carrington, and NXIVM's public enemy number one herself, Catherine Oxenberg. I don't remember specifics, but I do remember one woman complaining about how long it took the housekeeper to walk up and down the driveway to get the mail, and one obsessed with having crystal clear windows. I've seen a lot of failed projects, but the level of cringe from this one was really breathtaking. I'll never forget it. Thank you so much for this scoop. So it turns out that Catherine Oxenberg was like so close to being a real housewife. The spotlight fell on her housekeeper instead in what sounds like a really awful project that I'm glad didn't go to a series.
You know what's funny is that when they showed the interior of Catherine Oxenberg's house and the wall of religious artifacts that's so densely packed with crosses and stuff, I was like, man, a nightmare to clean right there.
Oh my God.
Who's going to dust all those crosses?
She has one of those houses that's like so white and minimalist looking, where you're like, oh, it must take so much cleaning.
It's white and minimalist, but it has a lot of tchotchkes.
It has tchotchkes. It's got spiritual tchotchkes. It also looks like kind of small from the outside, but like in a Malibu way, and where it's like, it's small, but it's like probably costs a zillion fucking dollars. But I mean, I wonder if Catherine signs off on that, if she like nominates her housekeeper to be in that show. Like, how does that work in that instance?
I mean, she would have to give permission at least, but I would imagine that it would be some kind of a weird casting call where people would recommend, like, oh, my housekeeper happens to also clean houses for so-and-so, like, and then put them in touch.
But it's such an obvious trap to be portrayed as a horrible boss.
Yeah.
Who on earth would sign up to let, like, a Bravo-esque docuseries be made about their housekeepers and their staff?
Probably someone who thinks they're going to come off as an amazing, gracious,
That's
wonderful boss.
True. Yes. And I can totally see Catherine Oxenberg being that person.
Honestly, like they rarely show domestic laborers on Real Housewives. They mm-hmm. did more in the beginning, and I loved when they would do that because you would see these people being such assholes to their housekeepers. Mm-hmm. And then maybe they realized that that wasn't good for making anyone sympathize with the housewives ever. But occasionally it's a plot line.
Yeah, it was this tricky thing they always do, like especially in the early seasons of those shows, where it's like they're trying to do this balancing act of portraying outrageous wealth and, you know, that kind of looky-loo aspect of it with like, oh, but you care about these characters. And by the time you've actually like gotten to the point further along in the series where you do care about some of the characters and you have to like be very, then that like, look at how outrageously wealthy or like entitled this person is, sits weirder and weirder with the rest of the show.
There was a big plot line on Real Housewives of New York where Sonia Morgan, who is like fallen from grace, she used to be married to someone from JP Morgan. And she's like very attached to the fact that she had this name and all this status. And then he left her. And so she just has the name and this townhouse. I love it because it's very like Edith Wharton. She's just like, I'm going to get back up there somehow. You know, even though I'm in my like 50s now, I'm like, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I just need a plan. But, you know, the townhouse is basically what she has at this point because she lost all this money and all these bad investments. And she had somebody stay with her. She had Tinsley Mortimer stay with her. And they fought a bunch over... she was like, you can't ask my maid to do things for you, even though you're living here. That's my maid and you're just my guest.
Oh my God. No. I mean, all of this just makes my skin crawl so much.
It does, but it's interesting.
It is.
Is Tinsley Mortimer a Real Housewife of New York?
Yeah, for like 2 seasons, although she just left.
Oh, I didn't know. I never watched New York, I have to say.
Her plotline is great too, because it's like she comes back to New York after being disgraced. She had a mugshot in Florida for trying to like break into her boyfriend's house.
I remember that.
But it's like she comes back to New York and she's trying to recapture the early 2000s, but they're gone, you know? So she dresses the way she dressed when she first became semi-famous.
God. That's and amazing.
Her mom is like this insane Southern mom who's like, you know, you're still going to like find the perfect husband and have a grandchild for me. But there is this incredible episode where they go to the circus together and they're both wearing like, she's wearing like circus clown, like cutie makeup because she is doing something on stage at the circus. And then she just has a complete mental breakdown at the circus with her mom.
Is she becoming like a, or like our first aughts Miss Havisham? Like,
oh, good call.
That sounds incredible.
Real Housewives of New York is so Miss Havisham. They're all Miss Havisham.
Because they're all single now, right?
They're all single and they all hate it and they'd all throw each other under the bus for a man, which is like a really interesting dynamic to watch on a show.
Yeah, man.
It's like a Sex and the City went on for 5 more decades. Like it's very...
Right.
It stops being glamorous at a certain point because I'm always like, these shows are a critique, which is what I tell myself so I can keep watching them.
Yeah, they, if you watch them the right way, they're a critique, I'll say. There is a critique available in the text. It's not necessarily at the top.
Well, they seem miserable despite the money, and they're so attached to this rich New York, Manhattan lifestyle that they have that it's like they're all just clinging onto it for dear life, and they refuse to do anything that might make them happy that isn't that.
Yeah.
Right.
Can I wait? This is like a little segue and we weren't necessarily going to talk about this, but I just saw this on Twitter this morning because I'm like probably inadvisably dipping my toe back in Twitter. But I saw a thread that was started by Sarah Maslin-Neer. She's a journalist at New York Times. And she, you know, there have been these threads all summer that are like, New York is dead, New York is over, etc. And she was just saying like, because I guess she lives in the West Village and she's like, it's actually totally empty. Nobody's here anymore. And then, of course, everybody's like, no, New York is stronger than ever, blah, blah, blah. Even though we're talking about a city of 5 boroughs and there can be wild variation between them. But like from what she was describing, it did sound like it, you know, Manhattan, i.e. the place where rich people live, is like completely emptying out. Like everybody is going to their country homes for real.
I think that is a real phenomenon. I think a lot of rich people have been fleeing cities for their vacation homes because they can.
Well, I also think that with the travel restrictions, that may have made things even worse, because I think as soon as it was mentioned that they were going to be restricting travel from New York to Connecticut, New Jersey, vacation home places,
everyone
was like, great, let's go right now. We're not allowed to, then we have to.
I mean, the New York Times has also run a lot of insane stuff about stuff like this. They ran that thing that was like turning your second home into a first home.
God.
Yeah. But I'm interested, like, and I'd be interested for any of our listeners who are in New York and specifically who can access like lower Manhattan and the most ridiculous parts of Manhattan easily. Like, I would like a scene report from like how dead meatpacking is right now.
I don't think it's dead at all, because I think it's I think it's like there's a certain class of person who's like, it's dead, it's over. And then there's all the like younger broker people who are like, it's amazing, we can just run around and do whatever we want. It's like old timey New York.
But this is the thing, is like, I think that part of New York has been so taken over by stuff that is only for the rich people. And like, you know, designer shops and stuff like the Marc Jacobs store and shit like that, and like hotels that are more or less non-functional right now, that I think that when you do take that cohort out of there, it does become a ghost town of its own design, because you did not design a place that is for everybody. You don't have affordable places to go do outdoor dining or whatever. Like,
right.
Also, though, just to be sympathetic to what New York is going through, my parents have a lot of friends who are older, like in their late 70s and 80s, and one in their 90s, and they're not necessarily wealthy. They're like long-term New Yorkers who basically have had to leave.
Have, like, rent control.
Yeah, but they are staying with relatives and staying with friends outside of New York, because for them to be, you know, walking around the streets of New York has just gotten to be scary, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They're high risk.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think, you know, I was having some fun thinking like, hey, New York's over. But then I was like, oh, but that's, you know, it's not just like all the rich people have been chased out. It's a lot of them are just old New Yorkers who are my
totally.
Favorite cohort of New Yorkers is like the ancient yeah. New Yorkers who have been there forever.
Right. And people who can't leave their apartments because they're immunocompromised.
Exactly.
I think that is a lot. Yeah. I mean, I just think all these, is New York over? It's like, no, when the rich people live, that's like when a city gets cool.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. I think that's the thing. Like, New York is over can mean so many different things to whoever you're talking to.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I wouldn't say New York is over, but I would say that, like, it sound like anecdotally, it feels like there was some kind of maxing out of the uber wealthy development that happened, especially like in lower Manhattan. And that is interesting to me, because it's like, oh, if that stuff all, if that really cannot get back up to that level of, you know, outrageous wealth and you know, nothing but Lilabo for miles and miles, like, maybe there's a chance for interesting stuff to come back there.
Yes.
Which is, you know, not necessarily looking for silver linings here at the moment, but that would be interesting if that happened. So.
Well, I love when people come to LA and they're like, oh, it's so dead. And it's like, no, it's always like this.
Yeah. Pretty much.
That's what we love about it.
Yeah.
I also, though, I think a lot about how families are doing in New York right now, and especially with the kind of clusterfuck that's been going on with schools reopening, not reopening. You know, it just seems like it's going to be this endless shuffle that's going to go on for way longer than a lot of families of young kids can handle. So I also just wonder, like, how, and I talked about this last week too, of like, well, you got to think about like the different architecture that will happen after this pandemic. It's so exciting because I'm so depressed that I'm clinging to these things. But I do wonder how New York is going to kind of reinvent itself as a place that can withstand these kinds of pandemics, because I'm sadly assuming that this is not the last one that we're going to encounter in our lifetimes. And, you know, I think about where I grew up in New York and how often I needed to get out of the apartment. And like, a lot of my friends were in one bedrooms with their families. You can't really be in a one bedroom with four people for 7 months. You know, what do you do?
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, is it's like, a lot of cities are based on the idea that, like, maybe you have a small apartment, but it's because you have the whole city as your playground. Mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. if you can't leave your apartment, it becomes a different thing.
And that's why I, you know, I take a little bit of exception when people are shaming people who are leaving, especially people who are more middle class or whatever and have that situation. It's like, the reason you're in New York is because of your job, needing to be, you know, having proximity to whatever industry you're in. And if that's off the table, why would you live in that small of a place for that much money? Like, I don't think, like, there's this wild, very tribal New York shaming thing that happens. And I, like, understand it if you're talking about people who have multiple homes and are just, like, ditching the city. But if that's your one home and you have a one bedroom apartment in like Crown Heights or whatever, and you're paying like $3,000 for it or whatever, like, I understand wanting to leave.
Sure.
Truly.
Also, tons of people are moving back in with their families because yeah. they have no choice, and
yeah.
they can't afford
yeah.
to live in a big city if they're not, you know, making a salary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I do think that every time there's been one of these things where it's like, wow, what an exciting opportunity to like remake the city as something good over this year. So far, it hasn't like turned out the way I personally would want it to.
Well, it's like such a years long process too, right? Like, I feel like you know, there's going to be a wave of stuff closing, or, you know, corporations taking their franchises out of certain neighborhoods and leaving vacancies behind. And then they're still probably going to only rent out those places to, you know, the kinds of businesses that can't afford there. And so it'll take several waves of failure before it's like, okay, like, mom and pops can have this place again.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. We're still at the point where we're identifying the problems. Like, we're nowhere near being able to implement solutions until we recognize how any kind of recovery is possible for small businesses and how much longer this will go on. I was talking to a friend whose doctor said, like, you should think of this pandemic as a marathon, then you're in mile 7. And I was like,
wait, how long's a marathon?
27 miles.
It's very long. I think it's 24.6.
It's that sticker that's on everybody's car.
You can tell that we all run marathons by our
quick. Is it 26.4 or is it 24.6?
I heard someone say 2022 yesterday.
25 or 64.
We're all moving to Chicago.
Chicago, baby.
That's where Tinsley Mortimer moved to leave the Real Housewives.
She moved to Chicago. Wow.
For love. And they were all like, how dare you leave New York for Chicago? You'll never be happy in Chicago. She was like, I've got a boyfriend. I'll be fine.
Well, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Night Call. So we have continued to get a ton of Pyramid Pals / Crazy Architecture emails and calls. We appreciate all of them. We've got, maybe we can like just tweet out a bunch of these or something. Because the thing is that there a lot of them are just visual and like, you know, we're a podcast. So there's only so much that we can get into with it. But we did want to highlight something that came up this past week in connection with the vow.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Can I? May I?
Please do.
This is one of those things. So we talked about this. We recently had a Patreon special episode with Nikki Mayard to talk more about the vow and the finale. And Molly first brought this to my attention, that Mark Vicenni was not a cult newbie when he joined Nexium. He had, in fact, belonged to a cult called Ramtha. And Molly mentioned this to us, and then I got so obsessed with Ramtha, I don't even know where to begin. I implore everybody who's listening to this to read up on Ramtha.
What if all of the vow was just like a long con to get people to join Ramtha? Because they're like, this cult sucks, but that
way.
Well, you could probably come away from the vow being like, all of these people would join another cult tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then they'd be like, it's not a cult like the last one. It's self-improvement, just like they were saying
it's
at the beginning
different.
Of joining Nexium. Ramtha's School of Enlightenment is a cult that's based in Yelm, Washington. It's started by a woman who named herself Judy Zebra Knight. She was born with a different name. My favorite thing about Ramtha is the origin story of Ramtha is that Judy and her first husband in the 70s were messing around with pyramids that they thought could turn things into gold and had like magical properties. And she put one on her head, like a little tiny pyramid. And then she spoke with a ancient spirit's voice and has continued to do so since then. And when we were talking on the, or maybe it was after the Patreon episode had wrapped, we realized Selma Hayek is a practitioner of Ramtha.
I think we talked about this on the pod. Yeah.
I can't remember if it was on the pod. We kept talking after we wrapped the pod because we were all like, let's talk more.
Because Shirley MacLaine has been involved
she
with Ramtha. And then Selma Hayek was as well. And then I found the connection between them and that Sundance Time's Up story. But
it was so wild.
It's a very deep dig. But the crazy thing is I went back and I read that article again. So this is, I don't know if people remember this. This is like a very like film Twitter thing that happened at Sundance a few years back. There was a luncheon with like VIP ladies of Sundance. And there was just an incident where Selma Hayek was like talking over Jessica Williams and kind of like referring, like she called her like baby and was just being like, basically saying that like, she couldn't like her struggles with like being a woman of color or being a Black woman in the industry were like not exceptional, and that we all had to like, you know, basically have a unified struggle together and not necessarily recognizing that it could be different for different people. But the language that she's using, because Shirley MacLaine is also there, is so NXIVM-ish that it's crazy. Like, I wonder if they also dipped a toe into NXIVM at all, because it's very like you can't identify as a victim, that sort of thing.
A lot. And also, I think that they do things like exercises where they get blindfolded and they all of these Ramtha people have to run around and like find objects that they've put in a field earlier and try and like remember where they put them, and then they bump into each other and get hurt. I mean, and also it has a very problematic layer where Judy Zebra will talk as Ramtha, but she'll say really racist or anti-Semitic things and then just be like, well, you know, it's Ramtha. It's intense.
Is that because Ramtha is an ancient Egyptian pharaoh? And so she's like,
I guess so.
Build those pyramids.
Ramtha also makes predictions. Ramtha likes to predict the future. And there's a really heavy emphasis on, you know, kind of quantum physics that you put through a sieve and take what you want, but it's not really quantum physics. But
sounds that, very What the Bleep.
I was gonna
well, that's
say.
What it is yeah. that What the Bleep was basically like a Ramtha project. And it's very odd that none of this was mentioned in The Vow. I feel like it's very germane to that discussion of him being in a cult.
Did we mention with Ramtha that Judy Zebra was born in Roswell in 1946?
We have not mentioned that.
Seems important.
Seems
very important. but it's also a really fascinating, weird kind of encapsulation of the topics we've been discussing recently. Cults and pyramids.
It's all connected.
Final destination of cults and pyramids is Ramtha.
This is Night Call Anon.
Yeah.
it all makes sense.
Should we take a night email about our weird buildings?
Oh, yeah, sure. Definitely.
Okay. This one comes from Smaller Demon. Loving the weird building emails. You could have an entire spin-off podcast based on it. Side note, maybe we just
maybe
do.
We're just
maybe
doing
that's
that right
this.
Now. It's a phase.
I'm an Alabamian who has lived in Nashville, Huntsville, Alabama, not Texas, San Francisco, and now back in Birmingham, Alabama. Alabama may not be a go-to for weird buildings, but there are some strange things here. Birmingham is home to one of the largest monolithic domes, the Faith Chapel Christian Center. This thing is nuts how big it is. Birmingham is also home to one of the most distinctive buildings I've ever seen, currently called the AT&T City Center. It was designed by Kahn and Jacobs, a firm that designed a lot of New York City buildings that would fall into the dreaded glass and steel category. But this building in Birmingham is a weird stone and glass building that I've not seen in many places. It combines black and white granite and shaded glass, and it's just really cool. But, and I'll make this separate from the rest of the email, the weirdest thing as far as structures, and I mean loosely speaking, in Alabama, might be the Ave Marie Grotto, with a link. Words are almost impossible to use to describe it. The grotto was built over the course of 50 years by a Catholic monk in the small city of Cullman, Alabama. Basically, it's Jerusalem in miniature built out of junk. Bottle caps, discarded glass, etc. Once you start digging around and find pictures and videos, you start to realize how utterly bizarre this is and where it is located. That said, Alabama is the home of EWTN, the cable television Catholic channel, too. So Alabama has a lot of weird Catholics. EWTN's headquarters are literally a mile from where I live. Please take a look at the grotto links, though. I'll send you another bizarre Catholic structure of Alabama in another email and some grotto photos.
I love a grotto.
Molly, you hang out at a grotto sometimes.
I do. I mean, I just love grottos. I love roadside architecture and stuff built out of junk by people. There's one in Cambria called Nitwit Ridge. That is a house.
That's a great name.
Oh, it's so great. I think it's Nitwit with like two T's maybe in both. But it's like a grotto house. It's like a Coke bottle type house. And you go there in Cambria, there's a guy who owns it. I think he's trying to sell it. So obviously we should make it the Night Call headquarters.
Yeah. Have you guys ever been to the Hollywood Sculpture Garden?
No.
Oh my gosh. See, it's a bit of a hike from from my current residence, but it is in somebody's yard. It's just a house. It's up in the hills, kind of above Beechwood Canyon.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's very ticky-tacky, just a bunch of stuff. Like, you know, the style is all over the map. but a lot of like mannequins and like vaguely sexy architecture and stuff like that. And a lot of like, you know, stone collages and stuff like that.
I just love when people decorate their houses weird.
Yeah.
Because it's so taken for granted that you have to have like a normal house yeah. that fits in with the neighborhood. And obviously in LA, you don't necessarily have to do that.
Well, it's really heartening there because everything else around it just looks like different iterations on the house from Parasite. And then you've got this right. total eyesore in the middle of it. But it's like very heartwarming to see.
Okay, so I was among a bunch of Parasite houses the other night. We were doing an action. And it was like up in the Bird Streets, which are up behind the Sunset Strip. And we walked past this house on the way to the house we were going to that had a million sculptures all over it of conquistadors and samurai. And on the roof, were like elephants. And you could just see there were like a weird waterfall or something in it. Just like the coolest, weirdest house I've ever seen.
Which coked up agent? lived yep. in that house.
Larry Flint. And he lives there still, I believe, because friend of the pod, Chris Chang, said Larry Flint lives around here somewhere. I'm going to go try and find his house. And then he called me and was like, it was that weird house that we walked by.
Wow.
And we were all like, what's up with this crazy house? So I looked into that house. It, before it was owned by Larry Flint, it was owned by Sonny and Cher.
Oh.
And it has apparently a red heart-shaped bathtub.
Cool.
That Larry Flint left in. And then another friend of mine said that she worked on something where it was right next to that house. And so she could see into the Larry Flint house all summer. And she was like, what crazy stuff am I going to see at the Hustler house? And then it was all like old guys that are friends of Larry Flint hanging out in the yard and listening to old timey music.
I like when it's like, what crazy things am I going to see? And it's like, they're just some old friends kicking it kitschy style.
I love old guys in the porn industry because they're so like overseeing naked women at this point. You know, they're just like family men usually by the time they're like of a certain age. They're like, oh yeah, I did all that. And now I'm going to listen to ragtime with my friend.
We don't have time to read all of these emails, so we're just going to mention this one here. We also got a night email from Zach about the Flintstones house, which if you can just look them up on Wikipedia, you'll have a fun time. It kind of looks like they're out of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And they're located in Hillsborough, California. But those are, they're fun to mention, but you just need to see them. We can't podcast
there
them.
There is a Simpsons house,
if
too.
If I recall, we did a whole Dome Homes run mm-hmm. a while back, and now we're getting drawn back into Dome Homes. So
just when we thought we were out.
That's how I felt about the second NXIVM documentary. I was like, just when I thought I was out, yep. they pull me back in.
We also, we started to transition a little bit into mounds last week, and we got an email from Catherine about the mounds of Wisconsin, which I had no idea about. But she said, true mound heads such as yourselves will probably be interested to learn about Wisconsin's effigy mounds. And these date back to 700 BC, and a lot of them are kind of formed as animals, like birds and turtles and buffalo and stuff like that. And some align with the moon and sunrise set on the solstices or equinoxes. And there are about 4,000 of them that survive to this day, which is,
wow.
I'd never heard of these effigy mounds, these Wisconsin effigy mounds. But she also says that Madison still has a ton of them. And one of them, the largest effigy mound in the world, which is an eagle with a 624-foot wingspan, along with a dozen other eagles, I guess, is on the grounds of the Mendota Mental Health Institute, formerly known as the Wisconsin Hospital for the Insane, where Ed Gein, the serial killer who inspired The Silence of the Lambs, and other famous horror stories spent the last 20 years of his life.
Wow.
Pretty wild stuff.
It is.
Did you guys see that Cat Nazca Lines thing that just got discovered?
What?
This like a giant drawing of a cat on a hillside in Peru, like an ancient drawing of a cat. It's so cool. I love stuff like that that's so old.
Yeah.
And you can still tell what it's supposed to be representative of.
It's interesting in this email about Madison having so many of these mounds, because it says that they're in city parks, backyards, cemeteries. Oh, yeah. And it's, I'm just like, imagine if you had a house with an ancient mound in the backyard. That's my dream.
Yeah, no, they were, she says that like the soil from the mounds is sometimes collected because it's like lucky mound dirt and people use it in their gardens.
You could make moon water and mound dirt and then you could just totally transform.
Yeah. That's what we're going to sell in our store.
You will ascend.
It's also crazy. The Ed Gein connection is crazy. First of all,
is it Gein, not Gein?
It's either Gein or Gein, I believe.
Oh, I don't know how to pronounce Midwestern
I don't know
names.
How to pronounce anything. I looked this up right before we started, but apparently it's so contentious. You can say whatever you want.
I'm going to say Ed Gein then. Ed Gein, just because he was famous for digging burial things up, you know? So interesting. He's surrounded by burial mounds.
Mm-hmm.
I have learned a lot about Ed Gein recently because I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is one of three all-time classic horror movies based on Ed Gein. The other two are Psycho and Silence of the Lambs.
I find it an unpleasant horror movie.
Well, it's super unpleasant.
No, but I mean, I like unpleasant, like horror movies are intentionally unpleasant, clearly, but I find that it leaves me with that scuzzy feeling that I can't shake, that I don't, I'm a little allergic to the
it's
Texas
because it
Chainsaw
was horrible
Massacre.
To make, and you can tell everybody's super unhappy on that.
Yes.
But it's exactly. So good, and everybody dresses amazing.
I find it obviously it's claustrophobic.
I just watched The Fun House last night too, which is the other Tobey Hooper movie about like a scuzzy carnival. I mean, his movies are scuzzy. That's what's cool about them. But like the Ed Gein story is super scuzzy. And part of what's so creepy about it was that he was just like some guy in a farmhouse and nobody knew he was like digging up all these bodies to make lampshades out of people.
Yeah.
I also heard, because I watched that Errol Morris documentary, I didn't know this, but Errol Morris was going to dig up Ed Gein's mother to see if he had, you know, dug up the body and done something with it, just based on the idea that he probably did, psycho stuff.
Yep.
And he was going to do it, and he invited Werner Herzog, and they were going to do it together.
Just and buddies then, on a trip.
Just buddies. Well, he was like a fan of Werner Herzog. You'd never met him before. This is when he was like young.
This is, my husband plays Errol Morris in a short film currently at festivals about all of this specifically.
Oh my God.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, then Errol Morris totally wussed out. He freaked out. He was like, I can't dig up a body. And that is when Werner Herzog said, like, if this guy makes a movie, I'll eat my shoe. And then he did.
He also like threw a ton of like wads of bills at Errol Morris, who then like threw it out the window. It's a very interesting and strange friendship. I like it.
I would love to get Errol Morris and Werner Herzog on Night Call.
Oh man, I would love to have Vernie on Night Call.
Vernie,
that happened.
We could just ask him about some mounds.
Mounds and rids. They could cosplay the mound and the rid and have a building personified conversation.
Do you guys ever think about how weird it is that we like bury dead people?
Oh yeah.
What else are we supposed to do with them though? Just leave them be?
Well, a lot of people burn them.
Yeah.
A lot of cultures just burn them. And have saved themselves a lot of space as a result.
We all still like the mushroom suits, right?
We love the mushroom suits.
Yeah. I'm still down for the mushroom suits.
It's crazy to think about how much space dead people take up in this country and around the world, you know, just
it's
like
crazy. Yeah. And how many like toxic chemicals are leached into the earth because of like the sheer volume of dead people that are in the ground. It's crazy.
What do the chemicals do?
I don't know. They can't be good. All that formaldehyde and shit, all the embalming fluids.
Right. I'm a big fan of cremation. Yeah, I think cremation very is, neat and tidy.
Yeah.
But that probably also is a pollutant when you think about, you know, the fumes.
That's why we got to do the mushroom suit. But I like the idea of the mounds because it's like, wouldn't you just decompose and help plants grow?
I mean, you should. But I think, I don't know, maybe if you're in a less densely populated area, like if you are a native person living before, you know, colonization and everything, and you've got the whole wide open country to yourself, you can just stick somebody in the ground and you don't need to worry about like making sure that, I don't know, they don't.
Well, you need to worry about the other people that are already in the ground, I guess. I mean, I think
it's too crowded.
Well, we got into this on our episode about Ghostland, but just the idea that like all of America is a burial ground, and mm-hmm. so like it's all haunted because it's all built on top of a civilization that was, you know, wiped out in a genocide by the people that built on top of it. The Shining.
Yeah. I just watched the second episode of the second season of Unsolved Mysteries.
Me too.
It's good. It features a woman who is an unidentified woman. They think she was maybe an assassin or a spy. She signed into a hotel under a false name and a false birth date. And it seemed to be a suicide, but then it seemed maybe not to be a suicide. She was shot in the head, but the gun was in her hand with her thumb on the trigger. And the forensics people were like, there's just no way that, you know, the crime scene just does not seem like she took her own life. It has to be a homicide. And maybe she was like a high profile assassin or something. Anyway, they had to bury her after a year and they had no leads on who she was, her identity. And so they buried her and then they decided to dig her back up, get DNA samples and examine her teeth. And one of the really interesting things was like they can find your age by your teeth. And it's not just like with a horse's teeth where you can see, oh, it must be this age because of the growth of the teeth. It's like the chemicals that your teeth have absorbed. It's weird because I guess your teeth absorb ambient radiation or something.
Oh, weird.
And so they can test your teeth and see which nuclear events you've been affected by and therefore discover your age.
Whoa.
That was a great, scary episode because it was just so weird that nobody could identify this woman and they were running her photo everywhere and just nobody had any connection to her whatsoever. But she was very specific looking and she looked just like Ghislaine.
She did. Oh. She looked exactly like Ghislaine.
Which was interesting because she was probably CIA or some kind, you know, not CIA, but some kind of secret agent for probably like Belgium or something, they ultimately decided.
Well, she had listed this weird small town, Verlaine, I think, Belgium.
She listed a fake name and a fake hometown, and then they went to the hometown to try and find her, and they were like, no, she's not from here. And then they used her teeth to figure out where she was actually from because of like nuclear testing. They could tell.
Whoa.
It was a really good episode. Dang.
It was good. And that's where I learned, which I had not known, that when somebody is murdered and they are a secret agent, they cut the tags out of their clothes.
Yes. So this happens like not frequently, but it's not the first time it's happened that they remove all labels from clothing and that they kind of like sand off any identifying information from jewelry and weapons and stuff like that. So there's absolutely no way to trace where the person is from.
Whoa.
Should we take a break and come back with a little bit of spooky Halloween chat?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Welcome back. It is the reason for the season, the big skeleton man, and the ladies of Night Call. We just wanted to talk a little bit about Halloween spooky fun time on our last episode pre-Halloween.
Yeah, obviously this Halloween is not like the others, but we have plenty of like Halloween material and stuff to do and activities and stuff, mostly movies, but also driving around and looking at people's insane Halloween houses.
Yeah, which has definitely, I would say it's dipped a little bit this year. I also just personally feel like it reached a peak a few years ago and then both people had less money to spend on Halloween stuff.
Yeah, we talked about this when we were talking about the big boy, the skeleton boy, which I still have not seen any. And I was driving around Burbank the other day. And
I know where a few are.
Oh, okay. You'll have to share off pod.
We'll make a map.
Share your secret. Make a map of the big boys. That's perfect.
They have medium boys in stock at Rite Aid. If anyone is interested in a medium boy, they're probably, they look to be like maybe 4 feet tall and they're posable. It's just big enough.
No, that's
it's not a big enough boy.
I've gone on several spooky cruises so far just by myself because I'm a weirdo. I went to Toluca Lake, which I recommend if you're looking for extremely decorated houses. Toluca Lake is like the place where they have really great lawn decorations of all kinds. But I also went to South Pasadena yesterday, which is where all the filming locations from John Carpenter's Halloween are located. And they always kind of go crazy for Halloween there, I think, because of that. But there were all these signs on the lawn that were like, no trick-or-treating this year. Enjoy the decor, but like, do not knock on the door.
I mean, it makes sense, but that bums me out anyway.
It makes sense, but it was funny. It's like they made their own sign for the neighborhood because mm-hmm. it's like a famous Halloween neighborhood that were like, please enjoy these decorations, but like, it's different this year.
Yeah.
A lot of people are taking driving tours of witch houses. I saw on like Hidden LA or something, like witchy little hobbit home, witchy little hobbit homes, I guess. I just saw there was an Ecto-1 in my neighborhood that was cool, inflatable wow. Ecto-1.
Wait, what's Ecto-1?
It's the from Ghostbusters.
Oh, is that the car?
Yeah, it's the car from Ghostbusters. Yeah. Ecto-1, it's the license plate.
I just Ecto-mobile. Call it the Ghostbusters car.
The busted mobile.
True Ghostbusters heads know that its license plate is Ecto-1.
Ecto-1.
But I appreciate when people kind of make the effort to like do it up because yeah. it is, it's kind of,
oh,
it's,
I
guess it's not the first holiday. We've had a number of holidays. We had the 4th of July under quarantine. We'll probably have a lot more holidays under quarantine. But for some reason, Halloween, this one stings.
Yeah.
Well, it's weird. It's like the one time that people go talk to their neighbors that they don't know.
Exactly.
It's like this, it's very surprising that we even do it because like there's such a weird social contract about it of like, this is the night where it's okay to just like randomly stop in at somebody's house that you don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't lived in a neighborhood that has trick-or-treating since I can't remember when. Like I anytime I move to a new place, I always like get a bag of candy just in case. I mean, obviously I'm not going to this year, but and then no kids come and I always feel
even
a
in New
sad.
York?
Yeah, no, I'm not in New York. I mean, like there a lot of times people will like be out on the stoops, but I didn't even see that in my last apartment. Like kids would go to the businesses, like they'd go to the, mm-hmm. the business street and like, you know, the delis and stuff, and they'd be handing out candy there, but they wouldn't be going to people's houses.
I've seen some kind of workarounds. There is a drive-through haunt that someone set up. I think it's the people who do the haunted hayride normally in Griffith Park, which is definitely not happening this year.
Right.
The drive-through haunt has gotten mixed reviews. People are like, it's not that good. It's kind of short. And basically just a bunch of people come up and like bang on your car, I think.
That sounds awful. I just discovered trunk or treat, which is you decorate the trunk of your car, you meet in a parking lot, and then whoever has the best trunk wins. But Halloween's not supposed to be competitive with in a car sense. I mean, I feel
also,
like...
Also, that sounds like a drug deal.
It does. Trunk or treat.
We all meet in a parking lot and open our trunks yeah. and give each other money.
Well, do you guys have any good Halloween viewing lined up or anything you've been watching recently that you've been really into that you would like to recommend?
I've been watching everything on MoviePass, which is my friend Michelle's Twitch channel where she's been programming movies all summer and they're doing a spooky past series that's all spooky movies. So they did like a really good Hong Kong horror day a couple days ago.
Cool.
Yesterday they did one that was all Dark Ride themes, Extremely Night Call.
Ooh.
And they showed Dark Ride and walkthrough videos between the movies. They showed Waxwork, which was really scary, which is like a Horrors of the Wax Museum movie.
All Wax Museum adjacent horror movies are like extremely scary and gross to me.
So scary. And then The Fun House, which I've seen before, which is the Toby Hooper, but I love it. It's people that these like two teen couples on a double date go to a super sketchy carnival and decide to stay overnight in the dark ride for fun. Spoiler, it's not fun. Also, it's another Toby Hooper, like, incestuous family of deformed people thing. So Yipes. He's really into that.
Yipes.
I thought that, though, it's because his parents ran a movie theater in Texas where they showed a lot of, like, Hicksploitation movies.
Mm.
And so that's why he makes Hicksploitation movies. And then they showed Final Destination 3.
Oh, great.
Which I couldn't handle because it's too scary.
I love really? The Final Destinations.
That's the one where I think it's Mary Elizabeth Winstead is the lead, and they're at a theme park, and she
yeah the theme park sees, one yeah
she
yeah.
sees that the roller coaster is going to derail and kill everybody and convinces people to get off, but then of course they are killed anyway. Those movies, those are the movies that I find like too bleak.
Yeah,
really, the Final Destinations.
Yeah, because you can't escape death in them. It's like,
well, you can't escape death in real life in either, life. Molly.
Exactly.
I know. That's why they're so fucking scary.
I don't know. There's something like so outrageous, though, about the deaths in them where it's like, this is like fate, like arranging the most grisly death for you. That is so, it's so nasty that I just like, it makes me laugh. Like,
right. No, and it gets into that Nightmare on Elm Street territory where it's like, you're going to have the death that like makes the most sense for you as a person. Yeah.
The tailor-made death is really alarming.
So scary. I might watch some Freddy movies. I've seen all of the Freddy movies a couple times now. Those are the ones that really freaked me out as a kid too much to even engage with. And then I finally watched them and they're really good and funny.
Emily, what are you thinking of watching?
Well, I wanted to just recommend a couple things. One, I think we talked before about the 70s horror series. It's on Criterion right now, which is really great. I did watch Dracula 1972 AD the other day, which is truly ridiculous, but just like, it's like a fun thing to watch. And then there's also, I found myself like browsing HBO Max, which I rarely do because like lately I've just had specific things that I'm watching on HBO Max. So I haven't been like going through and looking at what they have. But they also have a pretty good like classic horror or 70s horror situation that has like, I think they have like The Brood and like Carnival of Souls is on there. And a bunch of other stuff. I would recommend that. Oh, they've got Final Destination 5, too.
There's a really good movie in that 70s horror collection on Criterion that's so Nightcall called The Velvet Vampire.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
I haven't seen it either.
You recommended it, and it sounds great.
It's great. And it's directed by Stephanie Rothman, who's like one of the few women who made a bunch of Roger Corman movies, mm-hmm. who's really rad. But it's like the most Nightcall movie. It's basically The Love Witch, but about a vampire. And it's about a sexy female vampire, bisexual, who invites hipsters to come to her desert house in Joshua Tree and then seduces and destroys everybody.
That sounds great. When was it made?
It's so great. It's 70s, and it's like the most 70s movie. It's the most California Amazing. Goth movie because it's like she's a vampire, but she hates desert. The sun.
Yeah.
and she drives a dune buggy.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh
it's so Nightcall. And the guy in it is like the himbo from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
It is a delight.
Cool. I had never heard about it. That sounds perfect for Halloween.
It's great. Well, I had also been saying, like I had said like a minute before to my boyfriend, like, why aren't there more horror movies where all the victims are men? And then this was a little more like that.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. There should be.
Because it's all like dudes making these movies for the most part.
Right.
That's why I was actually a little like stoked about In Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, they don't discriminate.
No, they don't. Everyone's got to go.
What about you, Tess? Is there any?
I'm taking it classic style. We're going to rewatch The Shining because we're living in The Shining. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also going to force us to watch Pet Sematary, which I think is just such a terrifying movie. My parents are not easily freaked out, but in New York, they went to go see Pet Sematary in the theaters, and they had adopted a dog. I think they'd had dogs before, but this dog had like some behavior issues. He was just one of those dogs where you're like, what's going on in your mind? I'm not sure. And they got home, and they also had a very mean cat. They got home really late from the movie and like opened the door and saw the pets and like couldn't deal. They were like so rattled by the movie that they were like, are our pets like evil pets?
Oh, that's a good movie.
And they had to just be like, good night, guys. Like, we'll see you in the morning.
I'm also going to recommend that you guys have to watch Dr. Sleep because it is so bad.
I can't bear to watch something that's so bad right
but
now.
But it makes you appreciate The Shining so much.
But what about watching The Shining also makes you appreciate The Shining.
That's my thing.
Sure. But it's funny because it's like, you know, Stephen King hates Stanley Kubrick's Shining because it's like not faithful enough to the book. This is like his opportunity to litigate that. And so he just like makes it all completely literal. It's like just like here's all the rules and logic of the Shining verse and like the things that make the things in the Shining happen, which is totally demystifying and not something anyone wants.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's like a scolding movie where he's like, I'll do it right. Here.
It is so unscary, and the villain is a woman whose name is Rose the Hat because she wears a hat.
Well, I'm Emily the Headphones right now.
I just like want you to have to see it so that we can talk about it because it's so silly and dumb.
I never read the book, so I have no, you know, so reference good. Point for the faithfulness. I just love the movie.
I think all the stuff that Stephen King was mad didn't end up in the movie. It's like, that's what makes the movie good, is your brain is like trying to make connections and it can't fully make them.
Right.
And Stephen King is like, it's because he's an alcoholic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, that the book is great. Like, there, two things can exist in the world without...
I've never read the book. Maybe we should do it for a book club sometime.
I'm always down for some vintage Stephen King.
I've never read you guys know I've never read a single Stephen King book in my life.
Nor have I.
Forgot.
Oh, I guess I've read. I've read the anthology, like the short stories. But mostly I just would make Tess tell me what happens in them.
And I'm here for that. Molly, you read The Langoliers though, right?
No, I just saw the TV miniseries.
Oh my God, you guys. Look, I'm sitting on the floor and it's like...
You're like by a pile of your Stephen King pile.
Look, it's like I even have like current Stephen King. This one is the like second to last. It's all by my bed. And I'm embarrassed because like latter day Stephen King, like I could read something more nourishing for my brain. But
it's nourishing. The one that I always am like, The Girl Who Loved Tom Hardy. That's not what it's called.
But everybody I know who's into Stephen King is like a completist in that way. And I like, I don't look down on it at all. I think it seems really fun. I just never caught the train. I never got it on at the right time. And so now it feels really daunting. I did ask another friend of mine who is like a major Stephen King fan to like give me kind of a primer or give me like here's the first five you should read. And I remember that she recommended like, I think she recommended, I know that Christine and Cujo were both in that top five. And I was like, sweet, yes. I want to read both of those books. I just haven't done it yet.
They also go well together because it's the possessed car and the possessed dog. Cujo actually holds up really well. I reread Cujo.
Really?
But that was the book where I had my copy of Cujo. It was like a really cheap, whatever, shitty copy of Cujo. And I got maybe halfway through and then the pages started repeating. Like there was like a section that had been bound out of sequence. And I was like, this is a really amazing book because it's just, it's like making me feel like I'm insane. And wow, like this is really incredible work by Stephen King. And then I was like, oh, okay. There's just like a chapter missing and they accidentally repeated it.
It was just a printing error. That's amazing. Yeah.
It was just all work and no play makes tons of work. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Well, maybe we should take some night calls about the Stephen King-iverse to go into, to take us into November. We're also going to be doing some episodes about dreams. And so if you have any thoughts or maybe don't tell us your dream, because I think, I don't know about you guys, maybe we can talk about this later, but like listening to somebody tell me their dreams is like never the most interesting thing, but like recurring dreams are interesting.
Recurring dreams and prophetic dreams.
Yes.
And also, I would like to hear about some COVID dreams, because I know that is a documented phenomenon that people are having lots of dreams about, like getting caught out with no mask.
Yeah.
I had a really intense COVID dream last night that I won't tell you about because of Emily's take on this is true. But I did realize, like, people are talking a lot more about their dreams. I think people are having more vivid dreams in general. Also, if you have movies or books that you love about dreams, please recommend them to us so we can discuss those.
Yeah, definitely.
I was going to say it's one of like three stimuli we get now is like food, sleep.
Yeah.
If you're
lucky.
What's the third? I don't know. I was going to say drugs.
Yeah. You can say drugs. It's drugs. Keep it spooky, and we will see you all next week. Thank you for listening to Night Call. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a rating and review there, please. We've gotten some recently, and they're so fun to read. So thank you if you have left one. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Twitter at Night Call Pod and Instagram and Facebook at Night Call Podcast. And you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/nightcall, where you can get our bonus episodes, our newsletter, our mixtapes, and all sorts of fun stuff. Check it out. And we will see you all next week.
Bye.